Matt Wendell, as the managing director of Lotus Cars, tell me why Lotus is laying off 200 of its UK staff. Well, the people that were laying off were largely responsible for the development of the Mira, Via, and the Type 135 project, developing an electric replacement for the Mira and Elise. That work is now mostly done. What's your reaction to people who say that Lotus has lost its way? Nonsense. We're still very much adhering to Colin Chapman's famous adage. By freeing the company of unnecessary staff, we are clearly adding lightness. Hello and welcome to Gareth Jones on Speed. I'm Gareth, he's Zog.
Hello.
And I'm feeling a little smug.
Really? How so?
Well, you know, the government changes to VED, Vehicle Excise Duty.
Yes.
Which have suddenly added, I believe, 59 new vehicles to a higher band and all that. Well, the changes make no difference to me whatsoever. I've got a Band A car that produces only 89 milligrams of unpleasantness per kilometre, and therefore I don't pay any road tax, and next year I won't pay any road tax too, so nah.
Well, which emphasises what an excellent choice of vehicle you made.
Yeah. There's truth in that, man.
There you go.
You know, it meets all the standards. It's Euro 6. It's very low on emissions. It's incredibly thrifty, consistently 63 miles to the gallon. I'm loving a Citroen, as we do.
Yeah, no, good to hear.
You're not feeling smug for any reason down there? What are you feeling?
At the moment, I'm feeling a little bit smug because of my crushing victory in last night's poker game. Other than that, no.
Really?
Yeah. Hey, this isn't a poker show. I'm not going to go into detail. But I
can tell it was a good win. You're smiling.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I do usually win, but this was a good one. This was a particularly decisive victory.
Congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
Right, talking about victories, is the championship over as we are now days away from the Las Vegas Grand Prix with just Qatar and Abu Dhabi after that, after Brazil has dear Lando blown it?
I wouldn't say he's blown it. I think that puts a little bit too much of the responsibility on his shoulders.
Yeah.
But it's Max's championship now. The chance of Lando being able to make up the deficit now is vanishingly small. Yeah, well done, Max. It's a shame. Lando's bid was exciting while it lasted, but yeah, hope is drifting over the horizon.
That was a masterclass of a drive by Max in Brazil. Fair play from 17th to win. They just got it right, didn't they? Amazing he can do that.
Yeah, and it certainly helped that the safety car and the red flag happened when it did.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, no, it was a fabulous drive. Demonstrated just what a terrifically talented, what a spectacularly talented driver Max is. He deserved to win. He deserved to win the championship with drives like that, no question.
Well, a little previous, but a small applause for
Max. Of course, almost. Because
he can do it mathematically. Max actually can seal the deal on the championship at Las Vegas, I believe. It is possible.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's still mathematically possible for Lando to catch up. It's just, in the real world, incredibly unlikely. But yeah, the next race can put it mathematically out of Lando's reach, yes.
Yeah, well, it's been a good season. I've quite enjoyed every minute of it. It's not over yet, though.
It's not, well, and, you know, I think we said before, it bodes really well for next year. I'm really excited for how things are going to play out next year when, because we've got technical continuity, rules continuity from this year to next, we can expect the top teams to be as competitive with each other as they are now, more or less, which is fantastic. That means we can expect to have Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren, Mercedes fighting it out on fairly equal terms. And we've got a very exciting, driver move in Hamilton going to Ferrari. I'm super excited for that combo. So, yeah, it makes me very excited for next year.
The paddock gossip I hear this week is that a number of teams are considering doing not only no more aerodynamic development for the remainder of this season, but in 2025 as well, in order to get additional wind tunnel time for the development of the major step that will be the 2026 car under the new rules. So I think you're probably right. I think we're going to see a similar sort of season next year. It will be a fairly static period in terms of development, whilst everybody looks at the long game, which is coming out fighting in 2026. We've been treated, I think, over the last couple of years, I think the way that the rules work now with penalties and keeping teams within a budget, and not just a financial budget, but an hour budget in CFD and in wind tunnel and all that, is keeping the field close together and allowing this constant change, this ebb and flow. Hey, which brings me, right, constant change, which has been a while since we've had that. If you think about it, if Max wins his championship this year, he will only be the second driver in history ever to have won his first four championships in successive years. The last one to do that was Vettel, Sebastian Vettel, who did it in Red Bull.
Okay, yeah.
Max will have done it here. So once again, we have had a period of Red Bull dominance, but it's starting to wane. Max had to work for it a little harder. Here we are, three races from the end, and he's done it, right? Oh, well, he's almost done it. Oh, I hope I'm wrong. I hope this weekend something incredible happens and suddenly Lando's in the championship again. But hey, you're right. You know, we've had this period of stability, and now a period of change is coming. Change is coming. Do you know who else wants change in Formula One? Liam Lawson.
How so? What's he unhappy about at the moment, other than Sergio Perez?
Yeah. Yes, I know. But no, he's spotted. He's unhappy that the British national anthem, God Save the King, I think it's called, is played when McLaren win. He says, well, you know, he was a Kiwi, mate. They should be playing the New Zealand anthem, which I looked up. It's called Mana Kitia Mai Aotearoa. I think that's right. Aotearoa. You've got to say all the vowels.
Yeah.
Which is God Defend New Zealand in Maori. I've heard a lovely version of it played on the ukulele. It's a real sort of Polynesian vibe to it. It's really sweet, the one I heard.
I have some sympathy for his point of view, but McLaren isn't based in New Zealand. It's not a New Zealand team. The guy that founded it, fabulous guy that founded it, Bruce McLaren, was a Kiwi, sure. But he founded a British racing team.
Correct.
He didn't found a New Zealand racing team. So, yeah, I've got some sympathy, but I don't agree. No, you play the British national anthem when a British team wins.
And Liam Lawson's viewpoint is that, well, they play the Austrian national anthem when Red Bull win, and they're every bit a British team, even though they were founded by an Austrian in Britain. So the same rule applies. Red Bull should probably race under a British flag.
Well, okay, in that case, we could go and find the rule, I guess, about what anthem is playing. But Red Bull is an Austrian company. The company that owns Red Bull is very definitely an Austrian company. They may have a base of operations in the UK, but yeah, so I don't know how the ownership structure of that team works.
Yeah.
But Red Bull is an Austrian company, so it doesn't seem surprising that they're playing the Austrian national anthem to me.
Well, in that case, McLaren, who are, I think, entirely owned by the Bahraini Mumtalakat Holding Company.
No, I think
makes them a Bahraini team. They should play the Bahrain national anthem when McLaren win.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this is going to get into, I guess, some specific rule to do with ownership of the team. Interesting question. Yeah, I guess that's going to be something to do with the fact that the shareholders in McLaren own some kind of holding company, some company that directly owns and runs the team. That company is based in the UK, therefore it's the British national anthem, whereas the company that directly owns and controls Red Bull Racing is registered in Austria.
Yeah.
I assume that's what's going on, but I don't know.
This is a great feature for Ted Kravitz to do in the build-up to a Grand Prix, isn't it?
Yes, you're right. No, it would be. Yeah. Get on the case, Ted. Tell us what you can find out.
I'll write to Ted and suggest it. He's never sure of ideas, but I'll give him one. Yeah, this international ownership or unclear ownership regime that Formula One is very much in now and has been for a long time, really, is now extended to Audi with the quite shock news, in my opinion, in the last week. The Audi, you know, 2 years before they actually appear on the grid, have sold significant, or in the process of selling, significant ownership of the Audi Formula One team. Wow. What's your feel?
As you say, yeah, they seem to be in the process of selling it. I couldn't find anything definite in terms of, yeah, exactly how much they're selling and to whom, although it seems to be that investors from Qatar are most likely to be buying a chunk of Audi. I'm not sure quite how surprising it is, but, you know, I think we were clearly due some kind of announcement because one had the feeling that things had gone rather quiet with Audi for a while after the senior management of Audi had been shaken up, which had happened after Audi had decided to get into Formula One. You know, they appeared to be having a bit of a rethink about how realistic their plans were and whether they had the right things in place, and seemed to be taking a hard look at it. And there didn't seem to be many signals coming out about which way their thinking was going. For what it's worth, I was kind of getting the feeling they'd maybe be on the way to ditching the whole thing and just finding some way to disentangle themselves completely. But fortunately not. They are going ahead, but they clearly want other investors to come in and help fund the project.
Exactly.
So that's what is happening
now. I think they've realised how big the mountain is to climb and what sort of investment they're going to need to bring the Sauber, the Hinwil and Ingolstadt design and manufacturing bases up to spec. You know, there's some pretty high rollers there in F1. Aston Martin have got great setup now, haven't they? Ferrari are about to get some data improvements, their wind tunnel, which is going to make a difference, I believe. You know, they've all got... Red Bull have commissioned a new wind tunnel, I believe. They've been using one that's 50 years old. Mm. But Audi, here's the thing. Audi bought Sauber for €650 million, I believe. Now, the Volkswagen Group are talking about losing up to 30,000 jobs across the AG. The Qataris, and this is the curious thing, I was digging into this as I worked out, the Qataris have indicated they're willing to spend up to £1 billion on the project if the conditions are right. I wonder what that means, total ownership. Curiously, and I had no idea of this, Qatar is the third largest existing shareholder in the Volkswagen Group.
Mm.
I didn't know that. Porsche owned 53.3%. The state of Lower Saxony owned 20%. And Qatar Holdings own 17%. So it's something I was unaware of. I feel less sort of in conflict about this now. Okay, Qatar already has a relationship with Audi. Then them taking ownership of the Formula One team or part of it or a significant chunk of it makes sense, because it's the same with the Mercedes AMG Petronas F1 racing team, whatever they're called in their full title. Daimler don't entirely own that team. Some of it is owned by Toto Wolff himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and another element of it is owned by Ineos.
It does maybe suggest if there's already a significant Qatari ownership of the group. And obviously having a Formula One team is part of a marketing strategy to sell more of your cars. If they're getting involved in the team, that does at least suggest that there's kind of some coordination, that there's similar thinking, that there's agreement and a broader agreement in terms of this being a thing that they should do rather than, you know, a very expensive project that the company shouldn't be getting involved with at the moment. It sort of looks a bit more joined up and a bit more part of a strong strategy rather than it being a slightly desperate ad hoc move to find some more people with some money because we don't have quite enough of it right now Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they found it within themselves. They think it's worth investing because you can count Qatar as within themselves because of their ownership of Audi AG.
Yeah. And those deep pocket investors are looking at that and thinking, yeah, okay, we think you should go ahead with this rather than saying, well, actually, this is something that you shouldn't have got involved with.
Yeah.
You know, sell it off and get on with making more SUVs.
Yeah. While we're talking about Audi Sauber or Saudi, I think we should call them. It's a shame, isn't it? They're not sponsored by Saudi. Sauber's decision to go with Gabriel Bortolino, is that his name? And Nico Hülkenberg next season, that's funny, is intriguing because there's quite a lot of background movement in the driver market, isn't there? There was some suggestion that there could be a further shuffle where Sainz could not actually go to Williams at all, but he might replace Perez at Red Bull, and that would allow Williams to keep Colapinto or some other shuffle to happen between... the other one was Doohan, after five races next year, could be ousted by Flavio's favourite. That's Bortolini, isn't it? Flavio manages...
Bortoletto.
Flavio manages Bortoletto along with Alonso. So I think...
Mm.
I think there could be big moves there. I don't know. Jack Doohan, good luck, mate. Hanging in there.
I got completely lost in the suggested shuffle you were running through a moment ago. There were way too many...
variables.
speculative moves there for me to follow.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, Colapinto would clearly be, you know, somebody that a lot of people would like to see getting a race seat next year. But it seems like, you know, they weren't prepared to release him to Sauber, I think was that the case?
I think you're right, yeah.
And that may have been because there was a bit more prospect of him, you know, getting a seat closer to home, whereas I think with Bortoletto, he's a McLaren junior driver, isn't he?
He's been freed from his McLaren contract, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's it. I think they freed him because they I think, weren't confident that they'd have something for him in the near future.
Exactly.
And didn't want to hold him up. So good luck to him with Sauber. So what are you saying about Doohan, that you think his seat could be at risk quite soon?
Yeah, seriously. He made some statement that he had a contract to drive in 2025, not for or through 2025. And Flavio Briatore's influence is very strong, and he's mad keen to get one of his drivers in there. And basically, Jack Doohan is on trial, you might say, for five races. And if he doesn't prove himself every bit as good as Gasly in those five races, then he could be ousted. You know, welcome to the Piranha Club. It's an evil game. And isn't it nice to have Flavio back?
I don't know. He certainly creates stories. He certainly creates drama. But yeah, I don't think we need Flavio back.
Trouble is, we've got him.
Computer, this is Mohammed Ben Sulayem, president of the FAA. Please recognize my voice print.
Voice print recognized. This is the FIA, Artificial Intelligence. How may I help you today?
I'm very concerned about the bad language used by F1 drivers in press conferences. So what can we do about this?
Well, Mr. Ben Sulayem, sir, I may have a solution using technology.
Ah, this sounds good. Please explain.
There is software available that listens to speech, recognizes swear words, and automatically replaces them with inoffensive terms, and does so using the driver's own voice.
This is remarkable. We must have it immediately. I assume this is brand new and uses the latest machine learning and AI technology.
The FIA already has it, sir. It's relatively old tech now.
So why don't we use it?
Well, sir, it worked perfectly for every racing driver, except one. Which, when he spoke, the software simply couldn't replace the swear words. In some cases, it even made them worse.
And who was that?
Kimi Raikkonen, sir. Kimi. Fucking. Raikkonen.
Garrett Jones on speed! I'm slightly embarrassed by the fact that I drive around in a diesel internal combustion engine cars. Yes, I'm very smug that I don't have to pay VED, but I would love to drive an electric car. But the thing that's stopping me from buying one at the moment is the same thing that stops everyone from buying one. They're a little bit more expensive than an internal combustion engine car in most cases. And, doesn't it take ages to charge them? Well, it doesn't matter if you can charge at home, which I can do, so that second one is not really my problem. But how long it takes to charge an electric car, Zogga, is down to two things, isn't it? The power or the rate at which you can pump electricity into the vehicle and the management system that allows that, and the chemistry of the batteries on board. Is that right?
There's a bit more to it than that. There's the structure of the electrodes in the battery. The anode and the cathode also affects how quickly you can charge, mm-hmm. as I understand it. And I'm not a battery expert. But those electrodes are absolutely key. And in a lot of the work that seems to be going on with, you know, improving battery charging speeds, a lot of that is working on the electrodes. And it's not just on how you can sort of get your first one or two charging cycles done. It's also about how the performance of those electrodes is maintained over time. So, for example, essentially those electrodes will tend to degrade over time.
Yeah.
If you charge and recharge and charge and recharge, the physical structure, the surface of those electrodes will deteriorate in some way, and they work less well. And that's a major reason why your battery performance degrades over time.
You can equate it to elasticity in a rubber band, can't you? When you first get it, it's all taut and strong, and then after multiple cycles of stretching, cracks appear, and then it doesn't pull as strong as it did. It's just not as good at doing what it does. It's a reasonable analogy.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. I think that seems a good analogy. I agree, yeah.
The 100%. Other thing I understand is the degradation of the anode. There's a lot of work going into, and I know nothing about this, silicon anodes being a really good solution. Silicon, I'm reading this now, silicon is considered to be a promising anode material to improve battery performance. Silicon anode materials mainly consist of silicon nanowires, silicon nanospheres, and silicon nanoparticles and silicon thin films. Oh my God, I've never heard of silicon thin films before. Nanospheres, yeah! These are basic building blocks, aren't they? Flats and rings, and, mats and ropes and spheres.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned silicon sheets. I mean, that's presumably a silicon equivalent of graphene.
Yeah.
Single atom thick layers of carbon atoms that have a lot of potential uses, that are being a bit slow to commercialise because it's very difficult stuff to make, essentially. And silicon, it's an alternative to carbon as a material for the anode in your battery. And it has significant advantages because you can stuff more charge into it, essentially. Quite a lot more than with carbon. And it's lighter, but it tends to expand more than carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So when a carbon anode does its thing, when it's working, it will expand and contract a little over the charging cycles. Silicon also expands and contracts as you charge and discharge your battery, but it expands a lot more than carbon. And that's a big problem because, if your anode is changing size as you're charging and discharging it, there's going to be mechanical stress that could over time damage that anode and make it work less well. It's not an easy material to deal with and to just replace the carbon with silicon. You can't do that at the drop of a hat and magically get a better battery. You get a battery that really doesn't work. But manufacturers are doing a lot of work on combining silicon and carbon.
Ah, hybrid.
Yeah, and one of the companies that's doing this, Nanograph, for example, an American company, that they've recently got a decent-sized investment from the US Department of Defense, I think, who are going to use a lot of their silicon-heavy anode batteries in a lot of the battery-powered stuff that an army uses, radios, night vision devices, scopes, communication equipment, computers.
Yep.
And the advantage, I believe, that the particular Nanograph batteries that they're planning to use offer, basically they get about 15% better performance out of them. So they get, 50% more energy for the same amount of weight carried, or you reduce the amount of weight that you're carrying to be able to equal produce the same of amount of power at the end of the day.
There's loads going on. It's intriguing. You know, once upon a time, when we were petrol heads, you know, we'd sit down and go, oh, well, you know, the great advantage of the double overhead cam, of course, is that you can, the great advantage of the 16-valve head, the great advantage of the Schnurl port, or supercharging and turbocharging. It was mechanics that gave us better combustion, better performance, and we cared about that. It was badged on the car, S for 16-valve, turbo for turbo. And now, to get better performance on your car, whether it's range or power, ultimate power, it's chemistry. It's not mechanics anymore. It's chemistry, isn't it? We're talking about chemistry. So, you know, instead of having turbo written on the back, you'd have NaCl. Is that sodium?
That was sodium chloride.
Yeah.
Na is sodium. Cl is chloride.
Yeah, of course. I forget. Because sodium batteries are being considered again. You've been looking into this.
You mentioned this the other day, and I was a little bit sceptical, because the last time I looked at sodium batteries at all, I seem to remember them having relatively poor energy density. Mm. So they seem to be an unpromising tech for electric vehicles. But there is a bit more to it than that. First of all, sodium is cheaper and much more widely available than lithium. So if you're thinking about, you know, the security of your supply chains, or just having, you know, sovereignty over your supply of critical materials, sodium is a much better chemistry to pursue than lithium. Massively cheaper, massively more available. But the energy density is lower. Now, there have been some recent advances and breakthroughs. There are some sodium batteries that have energy density that is much more on a par with lithium ion batteries now. A company called CATL, for example, has a new generation of sodium ion batteries that are about the same energy density as lithium ion batteries.
This is the Chinese company, CATL. I think they are Chinese.
I believe so, And so those batteries would be, you know, certainly practical for, I guess, well, probably lower-end electric vehicles. The main application that they're anticipating for this generation of batteries, anything similar, is in kind of grid-level storage and sort of, you know, installed capacity rather than things that move.
Oh, right, so where volume isn't a problem, so you can scale up,
Right, and this is the thing, because they're not going to be high-performance batteries. You could broadly say that they're going to be cheaper and safer and maybe have some other advantages in the bigger picture than lithium batteries, but they're going to be bigger and heavier.
Yeah.
So they're going to be fine for an electric vehicle that doesn't need high performance and optimum range. You know, your higher-end vehicles will have different battery tech that is more expensive and gives you lighter high performance batteries, but sodium batteries could be a good low cost option for cheap electric vehicles, I think.
Yeah, I think that's its appeal, isn't it? It's a huge step. I don't know if saying quantum leap is the right word, because quantum is the smallest step available, isn't it? But we say it meaning a huge step,
I think strictly speaking, it's any step, it's any
sort of chunk. Quantum.
You know, when we talk about, you know, quantum mechanics, obviously that's tiny stuff. But you're right that when we say a quantum leap, we mean a huge leap. We mean a big chunk.
Yeah. So this quantum leap is alleged to come from solid state batteries, but they're proving to be tricky to build, expensive to build, and they will go on the premium vehicles. That'll be your Rolls Royces and your Porsches. Who is it who announced that they're going to put solid-state batteries into limited production in 2027. I think it was a Japanese company who said that. Was it Panasonic who've said that now, or someone else? No, hang on. It was Toyota and Samsung both said it.
They are pretty good on battery tech, so that sounds conceivable.
Solid-state batteries will become the premium battery. And where else you can use sodium batteries, if they prove to be workable, will go into energy storage on land or small city runabouts that only need 100-mile battery range or something like that, you know. So my belief, my interpretation is that sodium is the new wheat.
Okay, explain.
You want to take a guess?
Is it possible that the biggest sodium mine in the world is in Ukraine, which is also where a lot of the wheat comes from?
That would be a good one. That would be a good one. No. It's a kind of a philosophical view on it, I think.
Oh, okay.
Wheat is immensely successful. It's the big hitter. It's the Coca-Cola of food on the planet, right?
Listen, as grass-based crops go,
it's the best.
It's the best. Yeah. You can't beat wheat.
Yeah. We love your work.
Actually, no, you can. No, sweet corn actually is better. Ah. If you're going to... Well, this is tough.
Hang on. Here's the point.
Stick to the point.
But you're right to mention sweet corn. I'll explain why. Wheat is really good. It, like sodium, is available in a great range of places. It's more freely available than the more difficult to grow crops like sugar beets and all that, which require warm climate and extra water and all that. There's your lithium. But here's the thing about wheat. I had no idea. I've been saying for my whole life my whole adult life that wheat was arguably the first bit of genetic engineering by humankind, right? We grew and adapted wheat to meet our needs. And that's not the case. I've been reading about it. The truth is that wheat, this is a great one, this, domesticated humans. We didn't domesticate grass and turn it into wheat. Wheat demanded of early sapiens that they watered it and they bent down and they were able to plant it, and it would not exist without human or early human assistance. It was like a symbiotic relationship.
Carry on.
In other words, it wasn't the action of humans that allowed wheat to occupy pretty much every quarter of the planet. It was wheat that co-opted humans into its mission of success around the planet. Genuine thought, this. This is not one of my silly thoughts. I've been reading about it. This is the thinking now. Wheat domesticated humans. Humans did not domesticate wheat. But the point about wheat is it's successful and it's really quite average. There are things with a lot higher energy levels in them, a lot higher fiber level, a lot higher protein level, right? But they're a lot more palaver to manage. Whereas sodium is like, easy, make your batteries easy. Sodium is the new wheat, or sodium is the wheat of energy for cars, or energy storage anyway.
Okay, I still think it's a bit of a reach, and I have quite a lot of thoughts about that wheat versus humans narrative that you're teasing out there, but we don't have time to... I think I'm glad you got around to saying there was something symbiotic there, insisting too much on that. Yeah, because basically that sort of wheat domesticated humans or humans domesticated wheat. Either of these, it would be a slightly, be an oversimplification, I think. So well over the symbiosis thing, but no, that thing about you mentioned sort of it was you could argue that we genetically engineered wheat. Well, this is a very important point, actually. It's quite a broad point that what we've done, what human beings have done over our recent evolutionary history in developing all kinds of food crops and domesticated animals, we're doing exactly the same as people are doing with what we generally call genetic engineering. In an artificial sense, it's the same thing. And people, get, in my opinion, ridiculously alarmed about genetic engineering.
Yeah.
We've been messing about with genes constantly.
Yeah.
We just have better tools for doing it now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sprouts, great example, right? It's a completely different variety of sprout that we eat these days that we have engineered and bred very carefully. Even as recent as the 1970s, that's why kids hated sprouts in the 70s. And these days, kids go, actually, sprouts are okay,
It's because they're sweeter now.
So from sprouts to other technologies I know nothing about in the remaining minutes of this programme, lithium sulfur batteries, believed to be one of the most important systems that the next generation of EVs or next generation of electrochemical energy storage is going to be. Sulfur's low cost, highly abundant in nature, and non-toxic.
I don't know anything about that, but I do know, you're reminding me that when I was doing a little bit of research on sodium batteries, Ford took out a patent for a sodium sulfur battery in, I think, the 1960s.
Wow.
They've subsequently sold the patent and the rights to somebody else, but the Ford Motor Company had a patent for an early sodium sulfur battery, which I think was a little bit difficult to commercialize and to use because it required liquid sodium and liquid sulfur electrodes. So it had to be to run at very high temperatures. And I think I also read that they're sometimes used in guided missiles because you sometimes want they've got very good shelf life and can deliver very high power
for a short period. You don't need a lot, right? Because missiles aren't going to last once they're fired. They're not going to be around for much longer, are they?
It only needs a lot of short journey. Exactly.
Interesting. Ford, of course, were very active in electric cars in the 1960s. I remember they had a wonderful little vehicle called the Ford Commuter, which looked rather like the smart car, but some 25 years before the smart car. I thought that was
a neat bit of kit.
Oh, it was lovely, the Ford Commuter. Yeah, it looked like the early 1960s Ford Econoline, the American Econoline van with that snub front, but compressed like a Ford concertina, you might say.
It was,
that was lovely. All right, more battery tech. Last couple of bits. I'm going to finish on this thought about battery tech. Two bits of tech I'm intrigued in. Cobalt-free batteries. US Department of Energy is hoping to end the use of cobalt in lithium batteries by 2030. Cobalt is expensive and mining of it is associated with human rights abuses. So there's cobalt in the EVs that we're driving. Almost certainly there will be, right?
Yeah,
so cobalt-free batteries are clearly a human rights issue. And this is my favourite of all of them. Nanobolt lithium tungsten batteries. Now, these batteries have a web-like nanostructure that forms a large surface area. So you've got more surface area for ions to attach to during recharging and discharging. And so that allows charging to happen more quickly, or discharging to happen more quickly, I suppose. You can get energy out of it quicker. And it's all to do with surface area. Mm-hmm. And that's intriguing. You know, it's like a fractal thing, isn't it? The smaller the particle that you're able to make the thing from, the greater the surface area.
Yeah.
I'm finally starting to understand battery chemistry, you know, in the way that I understood engineering in cars. Just a little bit, And I want a car which says, you know, Ford Escort Nanobolt. That would be a good thing to write in the boot, wouldn't it?
Anything nano sounds good.
Yeah.
You know, nanotech is always good. Well, it always sounds good. You know, whether when you, you know, get down to it, this nano thing, whether it is a nano thing or whether it's giving you some real benefit is a whole other thing. But yeah, when we talk about nanotechnology, we're talking about technology that is sort of right on the dividing line between, if you like, regular scale engineering, you know, anything that you can do, and this could be tiny, you know, but it's still, if you like, regular scale engineering, physical scale.
Molecular level, is that right?
Yes, it is pretty much molecular level. It's above, it's sort of just out of the quantum sized realm, but it tends to be in a regime where quite often quantum effects are important, where they become significant and they play a part in why a nanomaterial will have properties that are very unexpected given what you're used to that material being like in its bulk. I mean, I can't think of a good example off the top of my head, but graphene, you know, one atom thick sheets of carbon, have very high, very good electrical conductivity and very high physical strength.
Yeah.
Despite being made of the same stuff as graphite is made of. And that's because it is a one atom thin sheet. It's one molecule thin, and you get slightly different kind of effects and behaviour than you get when you've got a bigger bulk of the stuff determining how it behaves.
I'm waiting for two things. Either the Higgs field battery, where, I don't know.
No such thing as 0 point energy, man. No, you can't do it. You've got to have an energy difference. You've got to have, you know, it's not enough to have some energy in the vacuum. You've then actually got to be able to have a difference. Yeah, so forget it.
How about this one? How about quantum batteries? Now, this is my idea. This is a quantum entangled battery where you have a battery in your car which is entangled at a quantum level with a battery that you've got at home which is constantly charged. And because these two things are tangled at a quantum level, the battery in the car will also remain fully charged. How about that for a scientific science fiction idea?
I'm going to give you two reasons why it's not going to work. First of all,
go on, then, you've got 10 seconds.
Okay, if it's entangled, it's going to be quantum scale, so it's going to be basically a particle or a couple of particles, and you're not going to store very much energy in that thing.
Damn.
And secondly, if you're planning to transfer energy between your entangled particles, you can't do it. All you can do is learn something about the other half of your entangled system. You can't transfer energy. Case closed.
Damn it, and I've just got $800 million development fund from a hedge fund for an investment in developing that technology, and I'm building a car using it.
If you stick quantum in the name of something, as a great many dodgy New Age people are aware, you can sell any kind of crap.
Yeah.
So, absolutely stick quantum in the name and it'll work.
As Nissan proved in America in the 1990s. Long story. Zog, it's been lovely chatting tech and science and chemistry with you in F1. One brother, say bye bye, and we'll see you guys in 2 weeks for more on speed and probably less chemistry.
If you enjoyed this show, then please like, share and subscribe. For information on how to contact the show, see pictures, read song lyrics, follow us on social media, or to sponsor this podcast, go to garethjones.tv. Gareth Jones on Speed is made in Wales by Whiz Bang.
Gareth Jones!